All right, hi everybody, and welcome to our Test 3 preparation class for those few brave souls who have ventured to be here on Thursday. And so, let's see how it all went. And so, let me bring up the test preparation sheets, and off we go to see how you did with these exercises. One second here. Okay, share screen. All right, we begin with the anchor facts. So, number one, which two anchor facts of history help us most to understand why English colonists coming to America had to get the permission of a king to do so? All right, so notice this is a very precisely worded question. We need two. And we want the ones that are most useful. So, let's see here. Not everybody at once. Timothy, please.
I actually can't talk right now.
Well, that could be better. Alexander says, why aren't there... Alexander, what's your question?
Well, it says... which two anchor facts? And that implies that there's exactly two, and I wasn't exactly sure which.
Helps us most.
Yes, but there could be different ways that they help you most.
Not so much. There are some that are more essential than others. So we are talking about the permission of a king. So some anchor facts are more useful than others in that regard. I don't agree with you that there is it's a matter of opinion. We've only got so many anchor facts. How many of them have to do with monarchy? So no, I don't think that you're right that there's a wide variety of possible answers. I think you could argue with maybe two or three, but that's about it. So it's not exactly a wide ranging answer, Sophie.
The monarchy symbolization of Menes Narmer unifying Egypt shows us that if a monarch says something is to be done, it must be done. Citizens of a country ruled by a king need his permission to do anything, especially colonize a new country. If democracies or republics were the government instead of a monarchy, everything would not have to be run by the head of the country.
Okay, so that's an interesting answer. You are right about the Menes Narmer part, okay? But I'm going to say that your second part of your answer isn't the optimal. Because what you are saying is, if it weren't this way, it would be another way. Well, but that doesn't help us to understand this particular thing. So there is an anchor fact that helps us to understand this fact, rather than some hypothetical other situation. Okay, so what could it be? Does this fundamentally have to do with Christianity? No. So Jesus is not going to be the milestone. Does it have to do with 1776? No, it can't possibly, because it hasn't happened yet. Does it have to do with 2011? No, of course not. 2001? No, of course not. So how many candidate facts do we have? Does it have to do with... There's only two others. That give us some kind of insight into this. So, Alexander, to your point, there are only three possibilities, and you got to put forward a good argument. So the other two answers would be 476. Now, how is that connected? Because it is connected. The permission of a king to do so. Of their king. Of the English king. This is what anchor facts are all about, so we should stop here and work this point some more. How does Menes Narmer gives us the baseline, tells us that monarchy is pervasive in history. It's indicative of that. Okay, but what about 476? How does that contribute to our understanding of English colonization? Okay, Timothy, go ahead.
I did not put 476 AD in my answer, but 476 AD would... help us understand England, because when Rome fell, the Anglicans migrated to England, and that was pretty much the start of the formation of England.
Okay, we can't say Anglicans, but I think you mean the Angles. You're talking about the barbarian migrations in the formation of England as a separate monarchy. Okay, so yes, that is relevant because we got English-speaking people coming to America. All right, so where do we get these guys? That's the question. So that's what Timothy's answering, is that the Angles and the rise of England and the English monarchy, that's a part of our context. Okay, but please, somebody, how do we get this at all? This is like answering question number 3. Right, Timothy?
Christopher, you need Christopher Columbus to discover America.
Yeah, exactly. You can't get the colonization of America through permissions of kings without the discovery of America. See, so notice how the pattern here is starting to repeat and how this can help us in our thinking. So oftentimes, with regard to these anchor facts, what you're noticing is you just cannot get to a certain juncture in history without one of these anchoring events. It explains the very shape of the world. If the event didn't happen, then the world wouldn't look like that. It wouldn't even be possible for us to even encounter such a context. That's how powerful these anchor facts are. I mean, you can navigate your way through history with just these facts. It's surprising how few of them, in a sense, there are. I mean, there are a lot more, but the most powerful ones are really powerful. They provide us with such a framework for thinking about history. It's almost enough. I mean, here we are talking about, you know, William Penn getting his permission. Well, that has to do with Menes Narmer and Christopher Columbus and the fall of Rome in a really interesting and instructive way. So those are the only 3 candidates, and you all you had to do was argue between those 3. All right, number 2. Which of the anchor facts of history helps us to understand why the American colonists rebelled against their king to form a republic? All right, Ben, try number 2, please.
Well, I wasn't quite sure, but what I was able to come up with was the birth of democracy in Athens and republic in Rome.
All right, which one being the most relevant?
Well, the most relevant being the republic in Rome.
Yeah, exactly, because you have to have, because the founders had precedents to work with. They didn't have to, so to speak, invent the wheel, to reinvent the wheel. They just had to look back and learn the lessons of history. So yeah, that's why they acted the way they did. They looked back to Greece and Rome, and Rome in particular. Alexander, go ahead.
The creation of the Athenian democracy and Roman Republic in 508/509 BC helps us to understand this act. The American colonists studied the historical examples of better government and were inspired to build on the examples and create a republic.
There you go. Nicely put. Okay, well-structured answer. Number 3. Use 2 anchor facts to complete this sentence. There could be no United States of America without... ... Be sure to include the dates. Sophie.
There could be no United States of America without Columbus discovering America in 1492 and the Founding Fathers signing the Declaration of Independence in 1776.
Ha! Okay, true enough. All right, good answer. Alexander, what's yours?
There could be no United States of America without first the discovery of America by Christopher Columbus in 1492, and second the colonization of America by the English colonists of Jamestown and Plymouth in 1607 and 1620.
There we go. That's another way to put it, and of course you can combine them in different ways too. Right, so again, 3 facts, 2 different combinations that you can work with there. Okay, number 4. An anchor fact is a present-centric fact from history. What does this mean? Give 2 examples of anchor facts other than those from our timeline and explain their present-centric significance. So we've just been having a long discussion about that, so you guys should be ready for this now. Juliet, please.
A present-centric fact from history is a fact which remains significant or has a lasting effect on the world we live in.
Good.
2 examples of anchor facts other than those from our timeline are... 1. Ferdinand Magellan circumnavigates the world in 1519. This is a present-centric fact because if he did this, now we have a much better understanding of the world. And 2. The start of Islam in around 622 AD. This is present-centric because now the war on terror, which is between Muslim terrorists and all other non-Muslims, becomes more noticeable every day.
Okay, right, all right, very good. Two good choices. The birth of Islam and Ferdinand Magellan's actions. And they really go together, too. It's, you know, it's an interesting combination. Because globalization is such a fascinating story, and we're in on it now, and it's such an interesting moment in history. I wanted to show you guys something, but it might take me too long to bring it up. This is really cool. Did you guys see this? Let's see if I can find it. World's biggest shipping... world's biggest ship. How about that? It's not on there. Is it the latest? The largest vessel the world has ever seen. This is amazing. Here it is. No, that's not it. Oh, come on, I wanted the pictures of it loaded up. That's pretty cool. This boat compared to the Sydney Opera House. Like I said, it was going to be hard to find it. If you Google that, the largest shipping ship there was just put to sea in China, and it's gigantic. It's unbelievable. And so it's a sign that in certain regards, globalization continues and is expanding still to this day. In other words, there's so much trade. Everything that links one other country to another is a link of globalization. Every time a country lays a transatlantic cable of fiber optics to increase the size of the internet, every time a ship floats from one country to another, every time one country tries to build a pipeline to another, those are all acts of globalization, of interconnection. And every time somebody tries to stop those things from happening, we are noticing a backlash against globalization. We're witnessing a certain kind of withdrawal from globalization increasingly. And so it's kind of neat to see this. It's not, right now, we may have reached a point where globalization is at a peak. It might go downhill from here because... In particular, there are a lot of people out there that want to hurt other people for no good reason. And that will lead to people being afraid of these connections that we now have. It will lead people to want to, and you see it a lot in American politics, the idea that the United States should not be involved in a variety of things. And if it were to withdraw, that would be, again, a kind of withdrawal from globalization. Because the United States is at the core of it. The world is America-centric. So whenever the United States decides not to do something, not to be involved in a sense, that becomes a step away from globalization. Because the United States is the one mainly that's managing it. And if it refuses to do so, then that tends towards the system falling apart. It tends towards disintegration. And we'll see that, I think. We'll see. It's going to be such an interesting time to live through. So anyway, that's enough being philosophical. But very good answers, Juliet. Does anybody else want to try out their answers on number 4? Test prep is all about trying and learning. So, Alexander, go ahead.
A present-centric fact is one which has significance to the modern world and still matters today. Two anchor facts other than those from the timeline are the start of the Age of Discovery in 1415 and the founding of Maryland in I Forgot. Without the start of the Age of Discovery, Christopher Columbus would not have sailed to Asia for Spain to combat the Portuguese sailing around Africa, inadvertently discovering America, much less the globalization of the world. The founding of Maryland, the first American colony to support religious toleration, a present-centric subject by nature, given the controversy over Islamic terrorist attacks today.
Mm-hmm. Okay, indeed. And it's fascinating to see how bold the Islamic world is in telling everybody else what to do. It's really quite shocking. And there are Islamic nations that say, we're gonna shut down your freedom of speech in every other country. We demand that you stop doing this or that. It's a completely opposite principle to the United States, the idea of freedom of speech. It's the completely, it's really shocking. And it's going to be difficult to deal with. So, anyway, okay. Let's do the simple stuff. Okay. All right, number five, the 13 colonies. Okay. Geography not the first. Oh, wait a minute. Do we have geography maps up here? What do you mean geography not the first? All right, Ben, give me the first five.
Okay. The first five are Virginia, or originally Jamestown, and then Massachusetts, Plymouth, New Hampshire, Maryland, and Rhode Island / Providence.
Okay. Ben, challenge question. Why doesn't this have a number?
I'm not sure, but I'll guess. I'm going to guess that maybe it used to be part of New Hampshire.
Close. Otherwise, there wouldn't be a line here. So, no, it wasn't part of New Hampshire. It was a part of Massachusetts. Yeah, so that's interesting. So, Maine was not one of the 13 colonies. It was part of Massachusetts at the time. Okay, let's have 6 through 10, followed by a difficult question. Timothy.
Okay, number 6 is Connecticut, number 7 is North Carolina, number 8 is South Carolina, number 9 is New York, and number 10 is New Jersey.
Okay, what current state other than New York is part of New York at this point?
What current state other than New York is part of New York at this...
As indicated here. Anybody know? Keen, go ahead.
Vermont
up here, right? The other triangle state, New Hampshire, Vermont, is inside New York up there. Didn't exist either. Okay, fine. And then the last three, please, Alexander.
Pennsylvania, Delaware, and Georgia.
Pennsylvania, Delaware, and Georgia. Okay, good. All right, so... Number 6, how did Europeans mainly think of America before colonization? What did Richard Hakluyt say to change their minds? All right, Sophie.
Europeans saw America as an obstruction in the way to finding Asia. Richard Hakluyt had many points to create colonies in America, to avoid trade with other European countries, to spread Anglican Christianity, to create an opportunity for more exploration, to make a base for fishing, and to attack Spanish colonies.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good enumeration. It wasn't necessary to have all of those in there. It would have been important to have the main reason, right? But good. I mean, I have no complaint in your answer. But it is possible to answer this without having the full enumeration. Does anybody want to try it in a little bit more of a generalized form rather than a complete enumeration? So, Alexander, go ahead. Okay, go ahead.
Before colonization, Europeans mainly thought of America as an obstacle on their path to Asia. In Richard Hakluyt's Discourse on Western Planting, he said that England should... I can't read my own handwriting.
That is not good.
The Americas as a way to escape the trap of spending more money than it earned, eventually letting its neighboring countries have larger armies. By sending colonists to harvest goods from America, England could get the goods it needed while keeping the money inside of the country.
Okay, right. That's a good elaboration of the fundamental reason, the most important reason. But make sure you formulate it in as precise terms as you can. It was a little bit awkward the way that you phrased it. Something about not earning enough. It was a little, I don't know. The key thing is this. not exporting enough, importing too much, right? If you want to use precise terminology from other countries. The key is international trade and importing too many goods and therefore losing the money, experiencing a loss of money from your country. Okay. All right. Continuing on. What was the first successful English settlement in America? Why was its survival so difficult? How did it finally succeed in attracting enough colonists to make the colony a success? All right, so a little bit of an elaborative question. Juliet, go ahead.
First successful English settlement in America was Jamestown, which was established in 1607 in Virginia. Its survival was so difficult because not only were the colonists under threat from the neighboring Indian tribes, but also most of the settlers were more interested in finding gold than in farming. The colony only really started to succeed when, in 1613, John Rolfe learned how to grow Caribbean tobacco in Virginia, which meant that the colonists of Jamestown could sell tobacco to the mother country, England.
Okay, but I want you to notice something here. You are missing something. So, how did it succeed in attracting enough colonists to make the colony a success? There's something very specific here about the issue of attracting enough colonists. So, you are right. Part of the answer, Juliet, is tobacco farming. But that's not it by itself. Because, okay, fine, you can grow tobacco there. But what if you can grow tobacco there? If you're just going to go over there and die? Right? I mean, you can't eat tobacco. It doesn't do you any good. How are you going to, you know, what's the incentive for this? It's more than just, okay, we now have something that we can grow. We have to have a formula for making it a livelihood. And how's that going? And there was another component to that. Okay. So Ben, go ahead.
The first successful English settlement in America was Jamestown. Their survival there was difficult because they were attacked by the Chesapeakes, there was no fresh water, and there were malaria-carrying mosquitoes during summer. In 1613, a Jamestown colonist named John Rolfe learned how to grow Caribbean tobacco in Virginia. The English had been buying tobacco from Spain, but they preferred to buy it from fellow Englishmen. Suddenly, everyone wanted to go to America and get in on the business, but not everyone could. So in order to attract people to Jamestown, the headwrights, they made the headwrights. So anyone could come to America and they would work for someone else for, I think it was 7 years. And then after that, they would get their own land.
Okay. All right. So that is
the last part wasn't part of my written name.
Yeah, I can tell. I can tell. All right. So you were on the right. You're on the right course, and you bolstered your answer there ad hoc or post hoc. All right. Anyway, that was the way to finalize the answer. Are you going to be able to read your answer, Alexander?
Yes. That last one was just really. So I did only the head rights and indentured servitude.
I think that's okay. I think that's the most important part, so go ahead.
Yeah. The first successful English settlement in America was Jamestown in 1607. Survival was so difficult because the colonists did not know how to grow food in their new surroundings. Furthermore, the natives were not friendly, so they built their fort on an island which was well protected but had no running water, and many of them caught malaria. It finally succeeded by establishing the headright system. Any colonist who voyaged to America and survived was given 50 acres of land. Additionally, if the colonist in question did not have enough money for the voyage, they could have someone else pay it for them. Upon arrival, they would work the payer's land for 5 to 7 years, then earn their headright. This was known as indentured servitude.
Okay, right. I would like to see, I mean, the best answer would have been the combination answer. Would have been an answer that didn't necessarily elaborate all of the Jamestown problems. You can just generalize. You could say they had the problem of fresh water, growing food, and fighting the natives. And then you could say, well, they finally learned how to grow tobacco, But in order to attract enough colonists to brave the voyage and the difficulties of starting tobacco farming, they had to offer head rights and make a system of indentured servitude. So some, you can have everything in this answer. It is an answer that is best served. Now, it's a question that's best served by a total answer, right? I mean, so everybody's got some ingredients here for a total answer, but I would say, yeah, everybody needed a little bit more to make their answer complete. All right, so that was a useful question because it really shows what it takes to make a full answer. Okay, number 8. What was the second successful English settlement? What was the reason it was settled? All right, Sophie, go ahead.
Pilgrim Colony of Plymouth in Massachusetts was the second successful English settlement. The Pilgrims left England to pursue a pure form of Anglicanism that more resembled Calvinism. These Puritans landed in America and settled Plymouth.
Okay. Right? So, in order to pursue a purer form of religion resembling Calvinism. Okay, right. All right, so, now, I think what's missing from that, Sophie, is that you're missing the part about religious persecution in Europe. Okay, so the essence here is, they're not just coming to America to do that. They're coming to America because it's the only place that they can imagine being able to do that. See, so that's the more complete statement of it, right? Because if you say they're coming to do it here, well, okay, why? But they could do that at home, couldn't they? No, not really. That's the thing, is they perceived that this was the way to escape the entrenched apparatus of religious persecution within the English state. That's the thing that they were afraid of, they were escaping from. Of course, the irony is that they themselves didn't really believe in it either. So that's where the next question comes in. All right, so number 9. Explain why it is incorrect to say that Puritans came to America for religious freedom. How do they treat people differently in their own community? Give examples to support your interpretation. All right, Juliet, go ahead.
It is incorrect to say that the Puritans came to America for religious freedom because they did not want people to practice beliefs other than Puritanism. They came to America so that they could practice their religion. They had little, if any, religious toleration, as demonstrated by when they attacked a neighboring settlement, Wollaston, because its settlers were celebrating a festival called May Day, an old Christian celebration. Another example of their lack of religious toleration is when they banished some Anglicans for simply trying to create an Anglican church in Massachusetts.
Okay. And the ultimate example is Roger Williams in his banishment. All right, so that's a good one. 2 examples is all you needed, really. When I say give examples, as long as there's more than one, then you've got full marks. Timothy, what's your formulation?
Okay. It is incorrect to say that the Pilgrims came to America for religious freedom because the Pilgrims were Calvinist and England was Anglican, and the entire reason they sailed to America was to escape religious persecution in England. They did not want religious freedom, they only wanted Calvinism. This is proven when a nearby settlement by Anglicans named Wollaston celebrated a non-Christian holiday called May Day, where people danced around a maypole. The Pilgrims disapproved of Wollaston and attacked it and arrested their leaders. The Pilgrims also banished anyone who supported any other religion or religious freedom.
Okay, now that's not an example. That is a general statement, so you're going to have to back it up. If you say, they also banished anyone else, well, that's not an example. An example is something that's concrete, right? It's a person. They banished, such as, now you've got an example, such as Roger Williams, okay? So be careful. The second part, the last part you had there was not an example. All right, Alexander, you?
It is incorrect to say that the Puritans came to America for religious freedom because they persecuted those in their community who did not accept Calvinism. They simply came because they wanted a different religion to be forced upon everybody, not toleration of different forms of Christianity. For instance, when Anglican colonists in nearby Wollaston, decided to celebrate May Day, a pagan festival, the Puritans arrested Wollaston's leaders. When a man named Roger Williams tried to preach his support for religious freedom, he was banished from Plymouth. He later went on to found Providence, a colony of religious toleration.
Okay, good. Continuing on, number 10. What is toleration? What two early American colonies had religious toleration? What is the relationship between religious toleration and religious freedom? Oh, this is a good interpretive question. So, hey, Declan's here. Did you do number 10, Declan?
So, religious toleration is tolerating other religions, even if you don't.
Okay, wait. To start with, do you have a written answer or not? Are you gonna try to do an answer off the cuff?
I have a written answer.
Okay, so, all right. So, go ahead and read it for whatever it is you've got. Don't try to improvise, okay? Go ahead.
Religious toleration is tolerating other religions, even if you don't agree with the religion. Religious freedom means that people are free to choose from any religion they want.
Okay, is that it?
Yeah.
Okay, well, all right, those are pretty good, except when you're giving a definition, it's not really helpful just to simply repeat the word. So you get, when you say religious toleration means tolerating, now that's called a tautology. You've just kind of repeated the same word twice, and you didn't actually make, you've got to go outside of the concept, right? You got to use, if you needed a synonym or, you know, name it in some other way. So here, I mean, to be an example would be, religious toleration means that you don't necessarily agree with other people's religious beliefs, but you do not persecute them for it. Okay. So that means the absence of religious persecution. It means you put up with things even if you don't like them. Okay? And then religious freedom means that you have the ability, you have the right to choose any religious belief you want. That there's no force. So now what you need there is the relationship. What's the relationship between those two ideas? Between tolerating and then the right to be free. I know that's a difficult one. I wrote it because it was a difficult one. But, I mean, this is where, you know, this is where history becomes interesting and worthwhile, is where we start to think. Not just to look at the historical examples. What's the relationship between toleration and freedom? Which is why you don't find toleration in Islamic countries. Keen? You don't find freedom in Islamic countries. Go ahead, Keen.
I would say that a king can say, you know, I will tolerate these religions. You know, it's not necessarily all of them. That's the first problem. But also, it can be taken away. It's not a concrete thing. If you have freedom, then it's a right, and you're saying that any religion, no matter what it is, you have the right to practice it. We're not going to only tolerate it, we're going to say that it is okay.
All right, Keen, that's a really good thought. So you identified something here, and so one is that freedom is a more elaborate idea, right? That freedom is more complex. It's a right. It's entrenched in the laws. It's part of the idea of rights. So whereas toleration is more just kind of a social norm, it's a way of acting, it's not entrenched as a legal protection. Okay, so that's a really good identification. On top of that though, you're right that it's more elaborate, more sophisticated to have freedom. The thing is though, one is a requirement of the other. And this is what I was hoping that you would see, is that tolerationism is at the root. You can't have the freedom without first having the toleration, right? You're not going to support people's rights if you're intolerant, That's the relationship. Now, this is what this the point that I was making about Islamic culture, which we see in the recent Paris murders. Islam is completely intolerant of other points of view. And so how do they act? They murder. Well, there's a perfectly logical relationship between those two. Intolerance and the taking away of other people's rights. It makes perfect sense. Now, of course, there are more tolerant Muslims living inside of Western societies and so on. But there has never been an Islamic society, an Islamic government that embodies those values. You don't see those in any, if you go to Egypt or if you go to Iraq or Iran or anything like that. And there's some notorious cases recently. There's a woman in Pakistan, I think, that's been condemned to death for being a Christian. And that's because the country, they don't have religious toleration. And therefore, there's no religious freedom. And there was another notorious case recently, a woman in Sudan. I think she was saved I think the United States gave her asylum. She was condemned to death for being a Christian. And just for that, for having her personal belief that was different than the state religion. And when it comes to Islam, to this point, all religions are historical. They change over time, just like everything else that human beings do. Christianity went through periods where it was extremely intolerant. Of course, Christians killed each other over differences in belief in the Reformation and religious wars. So Christianity is not immune to these challenges, but Christianity has evolved and under the influence of a lot of Greco-Roman thinking has really come a long ways. We live in a much more tolerant and benevolent society nowadays. But Islam hasn't undergone that evolution yet. And that's going to be the big challenge is we have so many societies, the West in particular, and the United States and Europe and South America and Australia and so on, all these societies where these values have been adopted. And the question is, can they be transmitted to the Islamic world or not? And if so, how? It's not easy to do, obviously, because it hasn't worked yet. And there have been so many attempts. And the United States has wanted to be this kind of benevolent empire in the world. Go and conquer Afghanistan, go and conquer Iraq, and then let them have democracy and let them experience what it's like to have a better life. And supposedly, they're going to want it and they're going to rise up and become more civilized. It's obviously easier said than done, because both of those projects have disintegrated. And the worst case, of course, is ISIS, the pure and just frightful barbarism in the social media beheading of Americans and so on. And the recent stuff that's going on in Europe is also really just terrifying. And so this is a hugely significant issue and a very complex and difficult topic. In the context of globalization, how do we manage these things? Now, what you can see around you is that people don't have good answers. And that's scary. You can see that the answers currently, we don't have the answer. When I say we, I mean just as a society. And so the problems will continue. There's no, it doesn't matter what you prefer, what you wish were so and so. We don't have the right answers and it's not going to work yet. So something else has to be done. And I think there's a lot of instruction to be gained from looking at Christians who have become more civilized. Christianity went through the Dark Ages, and it came out the other side. And Western civilization is much more civilized, period. So there's a lot of learning to be done from that story. It's really a great story. And so history here has a lot to offer us. It's not surprising that we live in a time when nobody knows history, and we can't solve this problem in its modern incarnation. Those go together. The impotence comes from the ignorance. The opposite of that is knowledge is power. So this is where history becomes, you know, you guys are at the cusp here, as you can tell, because I like to try to challenge you with these difficult topics. I like to challenge you because at some point you've got to hear these types of issues. You've got to face them. And you've got to see if you're ready to try to contend with them and work on them, because there's no choice. You cannot live in a hole and put your head in the ground and pretend it doesn't happen, because it will happen, and it'll happen to you and people you know. History happens, and you can't avoid it. So, I mean, at some point, you've got to get engaged and crank up your awareness and strive to become more aware of the world and try to figure it out and try to work better in it. Most people are really in a difficult position in that regard because they don't know history. So anyway, that's my philosophical spiel of the day. We gotta accelerate through these here. So, what was the most important colonial wars, and what was its outcome? Alexander.
The most important of the colonial wars was the strangely named French and Indian War between France and its Native American allies and Britain. The outcome was that Britain had conquered Quebec and most of the French forts to the west of the British colonies, effectively kicking France out of America.
Okay, it's not strangely named. It's named by the British colonists who were fighting against the French and their Indian allies. So that's why it's called the French and Indian Wars. People name the wars according to who they're fighting. So, number 12, what were the first two key milestones in the English tradition of liberty? When did this tradition first take root in America? Timothy.
First two key milestones in the English tradition were the Magna Carta and the Parliament. In 2015, King John wanted to tax the people to take back Normandy from France, but his people rebelled, captured him, and forced him to sign the Magna Carta, which stated that the king had to give a legitimate reason to tax people or declare war. In 1265, I should have put AD there, but Simon of Montfort, who was leading a current fight against the king, Henry III, called an order of the people to choose a representative for the fight against tyranny, which he called a parliament. In America, the first parliament was called in 1619 AD.
Okay, good. You misspoke, which I thought was very funny. You said 2015, and I thought to myself, yeah, maybe we should have a Magna Carta today. But anyway, you meant 1215. But yeah, I think we need a 2015 Magna Carta. Okay, perfect answer. 1215, 1265, and then the transplanting in 1619. And then a few quick ones. City named after an Irish lord, Sophie?
Baltimore.
Okay, and then Pennsylvania is named after whom? Timothy?
William Penn.
William Penn, and then the Latin phrase that means the way things were before the war, Ben?
Status quo antebellum.
Status quo antebellum. Okay, good. All right, so that went pretty well. I mean, kind of the way that I would have expected it to go. In other words, everybody nailed the easy ones, did reasonably well on the medium tough ones, and struggled with the hard ones. That's the way it is, right? So anyway, I hope it was a useful exercise for you and that it helped you to kind of increase your appreciation of the material. And so we come back, you'll have the test this weekend, then we come back on Tuesday, as it turns out, right? Because we have Martin Luther King Day on Monday. So when we come back on Tuesday, it is the top, the American Revolution. I look forward to that. Okay, everybody, have a good weekend. Good luck with the test. Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh, thank you.